We are honored to have with us tonight an exciting group of expert panelists for our topic, Inheriting Cancer When Risks Are in Your Genes. I will introduce our panel with a brief sentence and go into more detail on their background right before they speak. Each of our panelists will present for 6 minutes. So our panelists are Lily Service, who is a senior genomic counselor at Color, a company that analyzes 30 genes for the most common hereditary cancers. She specializes in counseling on hereditary cancer. Doreen Castleman, all right, is a retired professional social worker and performs volunteer work with refugees and high school students with psychological diagnoses. She was a late-stage cancer patient. Dr. Alan Ashworth is president of the UCSF Helen Diller Family Comprehensive Cancer Center in San Francisco and co-leader for the UCSF Center for BRCA Research. Dr. Allison Kurian is the Associate Professor of Medicine and Health Research and Policy at the Stanford University School of Medicine. Evan Goldberg is Chairman, President, and Director of the BRCA Foundation. He will be our first speaker, so a little more detail about him. Mr. Goldberg co-founded the cloud business software company NetSuite in 1998 and grew it into a billion-dollar public company with 5,000 employees. Mr. Goldberg is now responsible for product strategy and development at Oracle NetSuite Global Business Unit. He is on the board of the V Foundation for Cancer Research and is the co-founder and chairman of the board of the BRCA Foundation. Mr. Goldberg holds a BA summa cum laude in applied mathematics from Harvard College. So Mr. Goldman will lead us off by giving a little history about why he created the BRCA Foundation.
Thank you, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club for hosting myself and these much more distinguished panelists. The genesis of my interest in the BRCA gene and cancer genes in general and inherited cancer was meeting my biological mother. I was adopted, and when I was 35, I met my biological mother and father, who actually stayed married, and I found out I have 100% biological siblings, one of whom is here. You can try to figure it out later and see. My biological sister looks more like me, and I also have a biological sister who was affected by the BRCA mutation. When I met her, she was sort of deciding what to do and how to approach that. So I learned this when I was 35. I did a little research and realized, well, it affects women. I had a 2-year-old daughter, and I kind of treated it as like a software bug. Like, oh, I'm sure they'll have a fix for this in 25 years, so I'm not going to worry about it. As I grew older, at age 46, I talked to a doctor at a dinner, and he said, well, you really should get tested because it affects men also. And so I got tested. I found out I was positive, and now my daughter was 14, and it was looking a little closer to where she might be affected. I also had a second daughter and a son. At the same time, I, achieved some measure of success with NetSuite, and it gave me the opportunity to potentially maybe help with research. And so the first thing I thought I'd do is I'd give, money to researchers and help them. And I had a friend in Woodside, who a colon cancer survivor, who was BRCA positive, and he convinced me that we should do something more and, try to raise more money and potentially develop a community around the BRCA gene and individuals affected by the BRCA gene. So that was the genesis of the BRCA Foundation. And initially, I was going to really focus in on all types of inherited cancer. But as I learned more, and I'm on the board of the V Foundation for Cancer Research, and those incredible doctors, I learned a lot from them and about how the landscape of cancer was changing. And that, we had this way that we looked at cancers for, 100 plus years by organ. But now that we were learning these genetics, we were starting to look at cancers as a series of sort of genetic diseases. And BRCA cancers, that was a type of cancer that affected people with the BRCA gene, but also even people that didn't. There are cancers that for people that don't have the BRCA gene that are similar, and that we wanted to start to research treatments and prevention specifically in that way, kind of looking at cancer across a different dimension than just what organ it started with. So that's what really convinced us to focus it on the BRCA Jane, the BRCA Foundation, you know, helping to, you know, we're trying to foster collaboration across researchers across different cancer types, across different institutions, to help individuals and families that are affected by the BRCA gene. And, you know, we've, in the process, you know, developed relationships with great researchers like Allison and Alan. Even though they work at competing institutions, we've managed to get them together, and they actually talk to each other. So that's great. And, yeah, and so finally, the most recent thing that we've been doing at the foundation is a couple different things. We are trying to develop a sort of database of BRCA individuals so that we can help match them up with potential studies. That's one of the ways we're trying to help BRCA individuals in addition to funding research. And we've also developed a collaboration with some other foundations, the V Foundation for Cancer Research. That was sort of convenient, but what's actually interesting is, for those of you that know about Jimmy V, the North Carolina State basketball coach who died at age 46 of cancer and started the V Foundation, it turns out that he had the BRCA gene. And so we have that sort of connection with the V Foundation. There's another foundation on the East Coast that's funded a BRCA center at Penn called the Basser Center. And so the three of us are collaborating, and we expect this summer to raise at least $6 million for cancer research. And Alan's one of the members of the board that's going to, you know, help figure out how we can, you know, spend that wisely. So that's sort of where we are right now on the foundation. And I'll turn it over to our next victim.
Lily Service is our next presenter. Lily received her bachelor's degree in genetics and biology from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and her master's in genetic counseling from California State University, Stanislaus. She's had research published in Cancer, Journal of Community Genetics, and ASCO Annual Meetings Proceedings. She has also presented at the National Society of Genetics Counselors and National Consortium of Breast Centers. Lily will give us a speedy introduction to Cancer Genetics 101, and she'll provide some background and shared vocabulary that will be used tonight for the rest of the program. Lily.
Thank you. All right. Thank you for that. So I want to do a brief genetics refresher and get everyone here on the same page and hopefully create a foundation for the rest of today's presentations. So our bodies are made up of cells, and inside of most of our cells is our DNA, and DNA is packaged into genes. Each gene provides instructions, like a recipe, telling our cells how to make proteins, and proteins do everything from make our hair the color that it is, make our eyes the color that they are. There's also certain proteins that help protect our cells from cancer. Now, everyone's genes are basically the same, but there's going to be small differences referred to as variants or mutations, and these make us unique. Most variants don't cause a gene to stop working. They don't ruin the recipe, so to speak, and in some cases, they're beneficial. There are actually some variants that we do know will cause a gene to stop working, and these variants are typically referred to as pathogenic variants or pathogenic mutations. And like any genetic change, these pathogenic mutations can be passed down from one generation to the next. So in genetics, the testing not only has implications for the person themselves who's having the testing, but it also has implications for the whole family. And when one person has a mutation, there's a 50% chance that each of their first-degree relatives, so mom, dad, sister, brother, children, will have inherited the same mutation. And each child is an independent event, sort of like flipping a coin. And if someone in the family doesn't have a mutation, it cannot be passed to their children. It doesn't skip generations. And most hereditary cancer genes are inherited in this manner, or autosomal dominant inheritance. So only about 10 to 15% of cancers are hereditary. Most cancers are considered sporadic, meaning they happen by chance. They're not due to an inherited mutation. They're more likely caused by a combination of factors. And there are some cancers that are familial where they're neither sporadic nor hereditary, but they occur more common in a family than we'd expect by chance alone. We can't determine the cause. It could be due to a mutation in a gene we haven't discovered yet, or it could be due to a shared environmental factor in that family. So even though the majority of cancers aren't hereditary, people who have a mutation in a gene that causes hereditary cancer have a much higher chance of developing cancer than someone who does not have a mutation. And there are many different genes that have been linked to increased cancer risk. For example, having a pathogenic mutation in BRCA1 will increase a woman's risk for breast cancer and ovarian cancer quite significantly. Men who have a BRCA1 mutation have a higher chance of prostate and male breast cancer. And both men and women who, if they have a BRCA1 mutation, will have an increased risk for pancreatic cancer. Now, the reason we talk about these genes, even though they only account for 10 to 15% of cancers, is that if someone knows they have that high chance to develop cancer in his or her lifetime, the information is actionable. There are things they can do to prevent or detect those cancers at the earliest, most treatable stage. And Allison will talk about that a little bit later. And she'll explain sort of how these increased cancer risks are managed. But I also want to explain sort of how it works on a more cellular level and why that risk is increased. So overall, hereditary cancer doesn't develop that much differently than sporadic cancer. It's just that people who have sporadic cancer need two mutations in the same gene in order for that in the same cell for that cancer process to begin. Where people with an inherited mutation only need one mutation in any one cell in order to kick off that cancer process, because they start with one mutation in every cell in their body from the very beginning. So this is sort of the underlying reason why their lifetime chance to develop cancer is higher than that of someone in the average population. So lastly, I want to make a few comments just on how amazing it is that we're now at a place in time where we can unlock people's genes and figure out what's causing the cancers in some people's families. It's fairly recent that we've been able to do this. The BRCA1 gene was first identified by Dr. Mary Claire King back in 1990. Through the rest of the 90s, additional hereditary cancer genes were being identified. And finally, in 2001, we completed the sequencing of the human genome. Fast forward a few more years to 2009, when laboratories started using a technology called next-generation sequencing. And this was a technology that allowed people to offer panel testing for hereditary cancer. So it was a technology where you could sequence multiple genes simultaneously for lower cost than we used to be able to do previously. And labs could test many genes at once and help a lot of people figure out what there was causing the cancer in their family. They could look at many genes except for BRCA1 and 2, because at that time there was a patent on those genes. In 2013, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that genes cannot be patented, and the BRCA1 and 2 genes were now able to be tested by other laboratories as well. Today, because the cost of genetic testing has dropped so drastically, similar to all technology, a person can actually have high-quality, comprehensive next-generation sequencing for many genes for just a few $100. For example, at Color Genomics, where I'm a genetic counselor, we're able to analyze 30 different genes for someone for just $249. For anyone who's identified as having a mutation, we are able to test their first-degree family members through the family testing program for $50, which is offered by Color and sponsored by the BRCA Foundation. They help support that effort to identify people that have this high chance, with really the goal being trying to help people get more access to this information so they can be proactive and preventative about their cancer risk rather than reactive. And so next up, you'll hear from Doreen and her experience with BRCA and ovarian cancer. Thank you.
Thank you, Lily.
Just to mention that we have a table back at the back that has Color Genomics information, and they can explain more about the testing, and they have a couple of people here who can help with that after the program. Our next panelist is Doreen Castleman. Now, Doreen had no family history of cancer or the BRCA mutation, but she developed some vague and mild symptoms. She was found to have advanced ovarian cancer and later tested positive for BRCA2. After extensive first-line treatment, she had a relapse. This time, she was able to use a newly approved PARP inhibitor for women with the BRCA mutation and ovarian cancer. So this treatment has been effective for her for over 2 years. So what's unique tonight, though, is that Dr. Ashworth here is the person who helped develop the drug that saved Doreen. So Doreen will speak about her experience as a cancer patient. And before she starts, though, Dr. Ashworth, do you want to just give us a really quick explanation of what a PARP inhibitor is?
It turns out that when you have a defect in BRCA1 or BRCA2 in your tumor cells, you have an inability to repair your DNA properly, and you get a lot of mutations, and that's what causes the cancer. So what we're able to do is to turn that in on itself and say, well, these tumors have a weakness. We always think of cancers being very strong things that are going to fight all treatments, but they also have weaknesses in repairing the DNA. So what we did was, rather than fix that defect, we made it worse. People would thought we were a bit crazy when we started this. And when we did the first experiments, we saw these incredible sensitivity in cells in a dish, growing tumor cells in a dish, to the PARP inhibitor. And then we took that into a clinical trial, phase one clinical trial, and saw a lot of people with very advanced cancer responding. This is my entire 6 minutes, I'm sure. But fast forward 10 years from those experiments done in 2005 was the FDA approval of olaparib, which is the drug that you took, and subsequently two other PARP inhibitors have been approved by the FDA. And I'll talk a bit more about this later on. But. So that's what they do.
And I'm so glad they do. In October of 2013, I was working in a classroom with emotionally disturbed high school students, and one of my students went running into the street, or towards the street, and I sprinted after him. And I was so delighted that I was able to block him, not have him be run over. And later that day, I was, you know, musing on, I had just lost 73 pounds on Weight Watchers. I was feeling absolutely great, and just felt so good about my ability to move that quickly at age, I was, I guess, 57 at the time. Then I needed to use the restroom, and I discovered I had some bleeding, a little bit more than I had had before. I was attributing it to menopause. But I didn't think it was a problem, and I called my husband, who's an internist, and he said, you know, just why don't you just go in and get it checked? So I did. I went in the next day and had a very thorough examination, and my gynecologist did not find anything that seemed abnormal. I was very reassured. She suggested that I get an endometrial biopsy just to make sure, which I did with another gynecologist who, again, did not find anything abnormal. And I was very reassured. Then I went from there. We went and took our daughter to college. Our youngest started college because there was nothing urgent to deal with. We returned from Chicago, and I had an ultrasound. And at that point, it was supposed to be a 15-minute ultrasound. And after 30 minutes in many different positions with a very lovely ultrasound technician, it was clear that something was found. She didn't say it, but it was clear. So I received a call within a few hours from my gynecologist, who was very clearly very upset and apologized. And I had no clue at that point what she was apologizing for, but she suggested that I see a gynecologic surgeon as quickly as I could. And my husband was able to facilitate that. And I did see a very wonderful gynecologic surgeon, and he did a different type of examination and did, in fact, feel many tumors. At that point, he gave me the option of having a CT scan that evening, a pelvic CT, which I accepted because I really wanted to know what was happening. And I went in, and it was found that I had 23 abdominal tumors or lymph nodes, and that I certainly did have something that was found on ultrasound. So at that point, my gynecologic surgeon suggested that I get a CT scan of my lungs. And the next day I did that, and also many tumors were found there. So at that point, I was diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer. This was, of course, very difficult news, but at the same time, I had a coworker who had developed ovarian cancer, and she had many more symptoms than I had, so I really wasn't sure what was going on. And I then went, and there was a process of determining exactly what my origin was of where the cancer had started, and we started dose-dense chemotherapy. Like many women with BRCA mutation, the dose-dense chemotherapy worked very well, and I had no evidence of disease mid-treatment and continued on. I'll go a little more quickly. And I was in remission when I finished. At that point, my husband had found out more about PARP inhibitors, and I started a trial called SOLO-1 for olaparib, but recurred after 7.5 months. At that point, I found out I was placebo. I wasn't getting the drug. So then luckily the FDA had approved the release of this wonderful medication. And I started on it, and in 7 weeks, my CA125, which is a blood test to determine the presence of cancer cells, and I was back to my baseline. And for a little over 2 years, I have had an absolutely wonderful quality of life and been able to travel the world and really have almost no side effects. And perhaps even more importantly, two of my three children, adult children, have elected to get tested. And my daughter does not have the mutation, which is just wonderful. My son, however, does have the mutation. And his treatment has totally changed. He is at Kaiser, and they have been wonderful about very aggressively treating him, you know, removing any types of this is dermatological at this point, anything that could become a problem. And he has a whole awareness of what is in front of him. The geneticist that I met with when I found I had the BRCA mutation had cautioned me that since there was no history of cancer in my family, that it probably would turn out to be negative. And there is no known cancer. In fact, we've now had testing. We can't find it in our family. So without having the testing, I would have never known about this. And now what the BRCA Foundation is doing allows other people to know before they develop cancer. And I'm so grateful for everything that everyone is doing in this regard.
Thank you, Doreen. Dr. Ashworth was previously chief executive of the Institute of Cancer Research in London. He's been the recipient of many impressive scientific awards, including the European Society of Medical Oncology Lifetime Achievement, the 2015 Genetic Society Medal, the 2013 Basser Global Prize, the David T. Workman Memorial Award of the Samuel Waxman Cancer Research Foundation, and the Meyenberg Foundation Cancer Research Award. I'm sure there's many that we haven't covered. Dr. Ashworth is a translational biologist and laboratory researcher. His research focuses on understanding breast cancer genetics and applying what he learns to change the way patients are treated. He was a key part of the team that identified the BRCA2 breast cancer susceptibility gene, which is linked to the increased risk of some types of cancer. And then it was 10 years later that Dr. Ashworth found a way to kill off the BRCA1 and 2 related tumor cells by treating them with PARP inhibitors. So Dr. Ashworth will cover the discovery, development, and future prospects of therapies for BRCA-related cancers.
Thanks, Judy. Thanks for that very kind introduction. I have won a few surprises, it's true, but there's none of them that compare in any way than sitting next to somebody that you know, I'm just amazed that you fiddle around in a laboratory and hope that you're going to do something of worth. And it's turned into something that has been a treatment that has benefited now many people. I'll tell you a bit about the work because I think there's even more potential for this type of approach. So, as Judy said, I was involved in finding the BRCA2 gene in 1995, and it took us a long time to work out how we might use that information to better treat people, because this is a defect, that you have a lack of a gene, a gene's missing, it doesn't function properly, and we didn't really know how to attack that. And it was really, as I said before, this understanding of its role in keeping the genome in tip-top condition and having mutations that, of course, when you lack it, was the key to attacking the weakness in the tumor. And the reason that this is different from standard treatment, as I've said before, is that we tend to take cancer on at things that it's good at, and it's generally good at growing fast, and that's its major attribute. And that's why we use chemotherapies that kill fast-growing cells. And the price we pay is that we kill cells in the body that grow fast, like the blood, the gut, and the hair. And so we don't have much what we call therapeutic window to attack those. But by attacking this weakness, we're able to develop this therapeutic window. That took 10 years of people working around the world, not just our work, so that we could make this insight with this specific experiment that we did in 2005, showing that we could attack this weakness. And then there was a lot of clinical development that went on, again, throughout the world. And what we're seeing now is we've got drug approvals, three different PARP inhibitors approved for different indications in BRCA-related ovarian cancer. There's just been a positive breast cancer trial for BRCA-related disease of a PARP inhibitor. And the thing that has been amazing over the last year or so is that we made this insight in people with hereditary cancer, which is still a smallish group, a smallish proportion of overall cancer. And what it's turned out is that this discovery may be much more important to a much broader group of cancers that we think have an attribute called BRCA-ness. These are tumors that don't arise in people with mutations, hereditary mutations in BRCA1 or BRCA2, but these mutations are acquired as the tumor develops. And so they look like BRCA-related tumors. So the question is, do they respond to the same treatment? And actually, yes, they do. And this constitutes now 20% of the lethal form of prostate cancer, and 9% of pancreatic cancer, and so forth and so on. So the challenge now is to work out who is likely to respond, how long they're going to respond for, how we can stop resistance, and how we can make the best of adding to other treatments that we're very excited about, like immunotherapy. And I think it's just at a very interesting stage. The BRCA relationship treatment with PARP inhibitor is almost the poster child of personalized and precision therapies. As we've heard, the side effects, not everybody has no side effects. There are some, so in full disclosure, but they're nothing like the side effects of standard chemotherapy. And that's what we want to see, effective medicines that have a low burden so people can have great quality of life.
Thank you, Dr. Ashworth. Well, final panelist is Dr. Allison Kurian. Dr. Kurian's research focuses on the identification of women with elevated risk of breast and gynecological cancer and on the development and evaluation of novel techniques for early cancer detection and risk reduction. Dr. Kurian has published more than 100 peer-reviewed articles, including the Journal of the American Medical Association, Journal of Clinical Oncology, and Journal of the National Cancer Institute. As director of the Stanford Women's Clinical Cancer Genetics Program, her practice centers on women at high risk of breast and gynecological cancers. Dr. Kurian develops evidence-based practice guidelines as a member of the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. Dr. Kurian will speak about genetic testing and managing cancer risk. She will cover the clinical aspects of who should consider genetic testing, the testing process, and options for managing cancer risk through early detection and prevention strategies.
Well, thank you so much for that generous introduction. It's a real pleasure to be here tonight with this very distinguished panel of speakers. So I see my role as providing some context about what happens when a patient might come in because there's some concern about a hereditary cancer risk in the family. So for a bit of background, I'm an oncologist. I treat breast cancer primarily, but I'm also very interested in prevention, early detection and prevention. And I'm really passionate about improving survival and quality of life through catching it early and through preventing it to the full extent that we can. I think that's really the other side of the coin from what you've heard from Dr. Ashworth and from Doreen very eloquently. I think we really need to come at it from both ends, better treatments and also better ways of finding it early and preventing it. So my work is really focused on the whole population. I tend to look at people from the bird's eye 10,000 foot view and to think about questions like, across the whole population, who gets sick and who stays well? Who lives and who dies? So for me, these are really the big questions that we grapple with. I enjoy this kind of research because I see it as being a detective and it's sort of solving a problem. And I also think at heart, it's really about social justice in terms of who gets sick and who doesn't and how do we deal with the burden of disease.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So my work is really focused on improving our ability to understand a person's risk for developing cancer so that we can build a targeted and personalized cancer screening and prevention program for that person. So as mentioned, I have had the privilege of co-leading the Stanford Cancer Genetics Program together with my colleague Jim Ford over the last 15 years. My branch of it is the Women's Clinical Cancer Genetics Program, where we see patients with stories much like you heard from Doreen, who might come in because of their own cancer diagnosis. Here we're usually talking about a cancer like breast, ovarian, sometimes endometrial or other women's cancers, or potentially because of a family history of one of those cancers, or increasingly other cancers that we understand to be genetically related. You've heard a bit about prostate and pancreatic as part of the spectrum. And so when we do this, we have several tasks when we see a patient. I should say that we are very fortunate at our program to have outstanding genetic counselors like Lily. We have some wonderful colleagues. And genetic counselors are really, I think, a national treasure, if I may say so. They have a unique view of clinical work in that they see a whole family as their patient. And they see a whole family as their responsibility in the way that I think other doctors don't always do. So we have a bit of a checklist when a patient comes in. Usually they're seen by both a genetic counselor and an oncologist like myself. Our goals are to assess risk by taking a family health history. We think it's really important to take a three-generation history on both sides of the family. For example, some people think breast cancer can only come through the mother's side. Not true, as Lily told you. It's really important to get the whole picture. We're also assessing other risk factors that are non-hereditary, so thinking about risks of things like smoking and alcohol and that how that might play in to the pictures of cancers we see in the family. And ultimately, we will estimate the risk that our patient might carry a harmful mutation like one in BRCA1 or BRCA2. We actually use some computer models that can do this and give us a sense of, is the chance that this person has a mutation less than 5%, maybe not worth testing, although that's a very personal decision. Or do we think they have a very high risk and we really should go ahead? We always try to educate our patients about genetic inheritance, similar to what you saw that Lily presented, about cancer risk and what genetic testing can and can't tell us. It's important to note that while we've discovered a lot of the genes involved in hereditary breast and gynecologic cancers, there are certainly some we still don't know about. So we see a number of families where we're sure there's got to be something going on, and yet we don't find anything on our current tests. So there are some limits still, although we're moving quickly. One thing that I think is really important when we meet with a patient considering testing is to provide some context about what it would mean if we found a mutation in BRCA1, BRCA2, or a similar gene, both in terms of the care of the patient and in terms of their relatives. These are common questions that arise. People often want to know, what about my children? Would my children need to be tested right away? The answer with BRCA1 and 2 is that we don't test children when they're children because they're really aren't associated cancer risks. So that often can take a burden off people's mind to hear that. We do often outline things we might talk about if the tests were positive. So, for example, we think about strategies to prevent cancer occasionally, like preventive surgery. Sometimes a woman might choose to remove the breasts to reduce her risk of developing breast cancer, or the ovaries to reduce her risk of developing ovarian cancer. Some might be aware of when the actress Angelina Jolie did that a few years ago for a BRCA1 mutation, and that got into the news. We think it's important to talk about some of those interventions beforehand, not to say that anyone would have to do them, but just so people understand what testing might mean and what we might discuss. A few times I've had people stand up and walk out when I say, you know, if the tests were positive, we might talk about removing ovaries. A few people have said, that's enough for me. So I think it's important to give some context before people go down that road. If a patient does choose genetic testing, our job is to select and order the best test. Which genes? How many genes? Now we have a lot more choice. For about 20 years, it was BRCA 1 and 2 only. We're in this sort of brave new world of cheaper testing and expanded testing, and I think that's really greatly enhancing our ability to find answers for families. It probably doubles the proportion of families for whom we can find an answer. But there may be other costs, not in terms of money anymore, fortunately, so much, but in terms of getting an ambiguous result when you test a larger number of genes. So we balance that. If a patient does choose to be tested, generally results come back in about 3 to 4 weeks. Our practice is to call the patient with the results either way, so they're not thinking, oh, if I get a phone call, it means bad news. Either way, we call. And if there is a positive finding, if there is a mutation, our practice and that of many would be to have the patient come back in and meet with us face to face to receive a personalized individual plan for managing risk. And so with BRCA 1 and 2, there are a number of things we have to think about. We heard about the high risks of breast and ovarian cancer. For breast, we have good options, including screening, not just with mammogram, but also with magnetic resonance imaging, which is really good for high-risk women and can help us find cancers early. Some patients instead choose to do the preventive surgery, but if you look at the numbers, actually the majority do screening. For ovarian cancer, the main thing we have that works right now is a preventive surgery, although lots of exciting work is going on screening. And again, protocols are developing for pancreatic cancer screening. Many academic institutions have developing strategies for beginning to do that, often with MRI and endoscopy. We have different protocols for screening patients for prostate cancer earlier and for screening for melanoma, which I think we heard a bit about in terms of some patients. So we discuss these options and we help make a plan. We also offer participation in research studies. And finally, one of the most important things we then do after we've talked about the patient sitting in front of us is to review the family tree and say, which of your relatives are at risk and might benefit from testing? Because it's extremely important, of course, to find mutations among cancer patients so that we can treat them with targeted therapies, but just as important to have a positive ripple effect out to their relatives and be able actually to screen and prevent before any cancer happens. So we do active outreach. Genetic counselors typically will offer to write a family letter explaining this in plain language so that maybe if your cousin is someone you don't know very well, you could send a letter that says something has been found, here's how to get help. And we also tend to provide patients with ways to get their relatives in touch with local genetic counseling and testing resources. So I'll conclude there. Thanks very much.
Okay, now we'll move to audience questions, which I have here. If you'd like more, you can still submit them there, and there's pens in the back someone can bring to you. But Dr. Kurian, I think we were chatting a little bit earlier, and Dr. Kurian had a paper that was published today. So do you want to just bring us up to date?
Thank you. That's very kind. So we actually had a paper published today where we looked at the use of genetic testing among women newly diagnosed with breast cancer. And here we were not looking so much on people treated at institutions like UCSF and Stanford, but the average breast cancer patient treated in the community. This was actually two states of California and Georgia. And we were interested in the question of among women that we really think ought to get BRCA testing because they have suspicious risk factors, how many of them do? We found that only about half of them do. So clearly there's a problem in terms of what's being delivered. And we also found some deficits in understanding. So we found that many of the clinicians caring for these patients actually stated that they would manage an uncertain result the same way as a harmful result in terms of doing a preventive surgery. Now, that's something that our guidelines explicitly say not to do, and again, might lead to unnecessary surgeries being done. So I bring this up just to say that outside of specialty institutions, there's still a lot of work to be done in terms of making sure that this care is delivered appropriately, and perhaps more importantly, that patients and their doctors actually understand what these complicated results mean. So I think we have really work cut out for us in terms of education and different models, I think, for delivery of genetic expertise more broadly.
Okay, thank you. So we have a question that, what is the most effective changes in lifestyle that can reduce the risk of the BRCA cancers? Would like to address that. Okay.
All right, then. Sure. So I will give you my best take on this as an oncologist and an epidemiologist, which is my other hat where I think about risk. So interestingly, people have looked at a lot of risk factors together with a BRCA mutation to see if there's an association. I have to laugh because one of the first studies was about coffee. You know, someone really wanted to know whether coffee was a bad thing with BRCA, and good news, it's not. I just thought it was sort of funny that that was the top priority. So no risk there. People have looked at other risk factors, things like smoking, alcohol, things like that. Those are known risk factors for cancer. They don't seem to dramatically magnify the risk with a BRCA mutation, although, of course, we don't want anyone to do those things. We haven't seen dramatic signals with diet. Exercise, we think, may be promising. Again, not specifically among BRCA mutation carriers, but in general in terms of cancer prevention. And so we also see some protective effects of some of the reproductive factors that we see in general with mutation carriers. So some evidence that pregnancy may be protective. One thing that I think is really important to note is that taking birth control pills seems to reduce risk of ovarian cancer in mutation carriers, BRCA mutation carriers, as well as other women. There have been several studies that have shown that if you take birth control pills for about 5 years, you may as much as cut your risk in half for ovarian cancer as a mutation carrier and an average risk woman. So I'll put that out there.
Can I add just one thing to that? So I've often had patients ask when they're found to have a BRCA mutation, you know, what can I do sort of lifestyle-wise to lower this risk? And, you know, I'll say the same things that are similar things to what Allison said here, but I do always emphasize that you have a mutation that, you know, increases your risk for breast cancer quite significantly. Your ovarian cancer risk is quite significant. So you could do everything, quote unquote, right and still end up with a cancer. So that's why it's so important for, you know, these people to make sure they're working with their doctor to be on a screening and prevention plan that's going to be a little bit different than someone in the average risk population.
Very good point. Thank you. I think this is probably for you, Dr. Ashworth. How accessible are PARP inhibitors?
So the three PARP inhibitors that have been licensed by the FDA are part of standard of care for ovarian cancer patients with BRCA mutations. And with somatic, what we call somatic mutations, mutations that arise in the tumor itself, they're not licensed beyond that, but it is common practice in North America and the medicine to give things off-label. We come back to the issue when you mean accessibility about who's going to pay, and that's something that we have to grapple with every medicine, but it will be reimbursable with health insurance plans. And beyond that, it gets very complicated, but they are now widely available for ovarian. I believe there'll be a license for prostate cancer quite soon and probably breast shortly thereafter, and I would say likely pancreas as well.
So is that something, once you start taking a PARP inhibitor, that it's, you take it for life?
Well, the only experience we've got at the moment is in patients with advanced disease. And at the moment, I think it's probably a good idea to keep taking it. We don't know what happens when you don't take it. My guess is that some patients are flat out cured. Some patients, it's just being kept in check by the PARP inhibitor. And when we look at response rates of BRCA mutation carriers to PARP inhibitors, many of them have been heavily pretreated previously, and that also makes the response rate less. But what we see is that there's a group of maybe 10 or 15% of patients that once they go into remission appear to be still responding 8-9 years later. And so that's a pattern that suggests, doesn't prove that it's cure, but it suggests that it's likely that there's something interesting going on there, and we just don't know what would happen if they stopped taking it.
Yes. So I think keep taking it.
This question is for Dr. Goldberg. What has been... Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Goldberg.
maybe someday.
What has been the biggest challenge in sharing cancer data across state borders?
Oh. Well, you know, I think actually Dr. Kurian probably has some more to say about that. I mean, we what we're doing at the BRCA Foundation is very simple. We're just sort of becoming a clearinghouse, basically a list of people who are verified as BRCA carriers, but that's it. And other than that, we have their email and maybe their sex and age. And then we're going to be able to promote to them studies that they may want to participate in. So we're sort of just a middle person, so to speak. I mean, just helping to get better information to BRCA patients and or BRCA individuals, not necessarily patients. And so we're not really having to deal with any sort of health information. But I don't know whether you have
I don't think there's an issue in sharing data across state lines as long as there's been informed consent. There's some very large projects now. So assessing the genomes of tumors of patients in very large numbers. There's a project called Project Genie, which has now accumulated 8,000 tumor genome sequences. And what that allows us to do is then we can look at rarer subtypes, and the BRCA group is a rarer subtype. But then we can also look at any covariables there that, you know, shall we look at 5'10" women who with red hair within that group? You know, let's speculate there's something related there. With a few thousand, you can't do that. Well, once you get into the hundreds of thousands, you can start to unpick these relationships. And there's a very active feeling as part of Vice President Biden's moonshot that we should indeed be sharing data much more widely. And it's something at UCSF we're really advocating for.
So I just wanted to add to that. I agree completely. There have been some problems in the past because data are fragmented. So, for example, different people manage different data. Groups that run clinical trials have a lot of data on treatments and how well they work, but those only enroll 3% of cancer patients in the United States. Cancer registries keep track of every patient in the state. In California, every single patient who gets cancer is registered and tracked for life. That's an amazing resource we have, okay? We have that, but are there BRCA-related data in that registry? No. So it's a question of fragmentation. We are actually leading a project now in collaboration with the National Cancer Institute where we are actually linking those data together. So we have a project underway where we are taking all breast cancer cases and all ovarian cancer cases diagnosed in two states over 4 years. It's going to be more than 150,000 women. And we are linking to results of genetic testing provided by companies. So I think this will be a very exciting way to begin to get very big data and understand a lot more about, again, these covariates and people's outcomes.
Great. Thank you. this next question, I'm going to read it exactly the way it is, so there are numbers involved here. Okay, the stated chance for occurrence of the BRCA1 mutation in BRCA1 positive families is 50%. Please explain how a family with 7 children are all BRCA1 positive and the mother of these children is one of 5 children, where 4 of 5 are BRCA1 positive. What is different about families like ours?
Well, I want to make one comment on that, which is
You're
that
do the bees
what? No, just that my two biological siblings are both BRCA positive, as am I. And so my biological mother has declared that she has the super gene.
So it really is just sort of odds. And in that family, it sounds like bad odds that you ended up flipping a coin 7 times and getting heads 7 out of 7 times.
That I'm good at math, 1 in 128.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, so that's, you know, sort of the odds that you had to have that happen. And I think you said that the mom was 4 out of 5 had the mutation on her side of the family. So it's just sort of probability and, you know, I guess unluckiness in that family's case. I've seen families where they've had, you know, every kid carry the mutation. I've seen families where they're large, you know, groups of children and they all got lucky and didn't have it. So it's really just each child or each person is an independent event and has a 50-50 chance.
It's the same odds as having 7 boys in a family. It's exactly the same, right? And that's a rare event, but it's not zero. Exactly the same.
And there has been some speculation about whether having a deleterious gene might actually be good for you in a certain way, because if you think about evolution, and you have that you're blessed with, as well as having something that's deleterious, and that actually it ends up propagating a mutant gene through a population that way. But there's no real evidence for that. But we do know with sickle cell anemia, for example, that's an example where that trait confers resistance to a parasite, and that that actually allows you to survive under conditions you wouldn't. So we've no idea whether Evan has a superpower. That math is his superpower.
Yeah, maybe math.
So Dr. Ashworth, to continue on, given the broad mechanism of the BRCA gene, why don't we find the mutation impacting all tumors?
Very good question. I've been asked that question every talk I've given since 1995.
That's a great question.
And I still don't know the answer. So it is true to say that if you have a BRCA mutation, you are not at elevated risk of cancer of the colon, for example. We just don't really see that. There's a big debate. I mean, there's some cancers where there's small effects, and there's people argue about it. But we don't see much brain cancer. There's other things that you don't see. And probably what it is that cells have to be able to tolerate the loss of the gene and survive. Mm-hmm. And some cells can survive, and they become cancers. And some cells can't survive, and they therefore can't become cancers. So I think that's something to do with it. There may be also some environmental interaction as well, but we really don't know. What we do have in common is that the tissues affected are largely secretory tissues, so the breast, the ovarian, kind of hormonal influence, prostate cancer with influence of male hormones. To stretch it a bit, pancreas is a hormonally affected tissue. So there's maybe something to do with that as well, but the simple answer is we don't really know.
Okay. Have there been any studies of patients with both the BRCA mutation and autoimmune diseases and disease-modifying agents?
I'll come right out and say I don't know, so there we are. I will say that there are some older data on patients with rheumatologic diseases, with autoimmune diseases, that actually suggest in some cases a lower cancer risk. Sometimes that can be confounded by risks related to medications they take, but there have been some papers that actually suggest the risk may be lower, which is really interesting, right? So if their immune system is on a little bit more, could that help in some ways? I think it's not as clear-cut as that, but they're interesting questions about what autoimmunity might mean in terms of risk.
And there is also some evidence that if you have a breast cancer that is caused by a BRCA1 mutation, there are more immune cells within the tumor. Mm-hmm. So somehow the tumor is triggering some immunological response that turns out not to be that productive because the tumor is still there, but it's kind of trying to attack it. So that's hinting at there's something happening, some relationship to the immune system. And this is really the basis of thinking that using drugs that can stimulate the immune system mm-hmm. might be particularly productive in this group of tumors.
Okay. When should males be tested for the mutation, the BRCA mutation? What age?
Well, I learned it was age 40. That's what I was told when I was 46. Oops.
That's a little later than I would generally recommend if there's a mutation known to be running in the family. So typically sort of the rule of thumb that I'm sure you guys probably use in your clinic is doing testing at the age at which you'd start doing screening. And so for women, you really start doing screening around age 25. For men, you can start skin cancer screening for BRCA2 a little bit earlier, but usually you start doing, you know, self-chest exam, prostate cancer screening around like 35 or 40. So that's when they maybe want to do testing, or they could do it a little bit earlier.
Right. Mine was for male.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just my opinion, but I think people should be tested when they want to be tested. if they're all grown up, and particularly, I mean, women want to plan their families, and they, you know, they want to plan really well ahead, and people want to, you know, control of their lives, they should do it when they feel comfortable with it.
The screening after age
full,
is the ceiling.
Full informed, yep. You know, the benefits and the disadvantages.
So I agree completely. I would just say that what we tend to see clinically is men either coming in because of needing to start prostate cancer screening earlier, like at 40. The other reason we see men coming in, again, is family planning. Mm-hmm. And so there are, in fact, strategies that happen now that allow people to make decisions about whether they might screen embryos for having a BRCA mutation. I think, again, there are always different opinions ethically about that, but it is done clinically. So I mention that just because sometimes people might choose to do something called in vitro fertilization, where people are doing test tube egg and sperm and not implanted or anything like that. They would test for the BRCA mutation and only implant an embryo to carry that didn't have it. Again, I don't say that in any means of saying that it should be done or anything like that, but it is being done and it is available.
And just a reminder on what Allison said is that it's not testing little kids. This is something that gets done in people once they're over the age of 18 and can decide that they want to have this information, and it would be useful information for them to have.
Very good point. And that's why sort of family planning for young adults might be a time that some think about it.
Okay, thank you. You actually answered another question automatically. Dr. Ashworth, again, could you talk about the work on preventing resistance to PARP inhibitors?
So we know that for therapies that target particular genetic lesions in tumors, there is the possibility that the cell can do a workaround, and it can do it genetically. So we can get a mutation in another gene that just does what the thing that was supposed to be blocked does. And it actually just figures out a way of going the other way. So I guess it's like Waze, where the road's blocked. It goes, it kind of goes around it, and it does it in a very kind of automatic, cells are very sophisticated wiring diagrams. And basically, if you block one road, it'll find another. And the challenge is to block off enough roads so that it hasn't got anywhere to go. And so what we're really thinking about is, do we give treatment continuously? We've talked about that. Do we give it in an intermittent fashion? Do we mix it up with something else? Do we combine it with something else? Really, for those patients where they haven't had a knockout blow to the tumor, can we actually get the knockout blow by doing it in a different way? So this is a very active area of research. I've talked about the combination with immune stimulatory agents. There are many other agents that are being considered as combination, really to up that response rate, get the maximum number of people cured flat out, and for those that we can't cure, to keep the disease under control for a very long period.
Thank you. Mr. Goldberg, is funding that you raise going towards investment in health IT?
No, we're generally raising money for medical research, and also we've raised money for family testing, I think that's a, you know, you always have to choose. There's so many, you know, great ways that you can be funding great ideas and great initiatives. I think it's incredibly important. It relates to what Allison said about kind of getting the medical records tied together and to get the best possible data. I mean, I'm a huge believer. I work for Oracle, you know, the database company, a huge believer that, as does your husband. Yeah. And so you should be hitting him up for good ideas on databases, right? But no, I mean, we need better databases. We need better data. We need to be able to do these massive big data studies to understand correlations and that potentially may be causations. Mm-hmm. And that requires some really big advances in health IT. So we're not directly working on it, but I certainly hope that there are people that are.
Okay, thank you. For genetic testing today that shows a genetic pathologic gene with little information available due to low numbers, how do you track a population with these type of genes? The example is I had ovarian cancer. My paternal grandmother had it, but my BARD1 mutation is not high risk. Not enough information yet.
Go ahead.
I'll start. So, you know, very interesting situation. I think I'm not sure exactly what the case was with the BARD1 mutation. I can think of two things. One thing is that it was a true sort of harmful mutation, which Lily talked about, where it really knocks out the ability of that gene to function. The challenge is that we don't quite know how important BARD1 is in terms of ovarian cancer risk. Could that be the cause of the ovarian cancers in the family? We're not really sure because it's a newly studied gene, and we don't have a sense of how high the cancer risks are the way we do with BRCA1. The other possibility that they might have been talking about is that perhaps it was a change in the BARD1 gene where it might not really have been a harmful change, but an uncertain change. So there are sort of two levels of uncertainty. It might be a really bad mutation, but we don't know how high the risk is, or something that isn't quite a mutation. So you see the multiple layers of uncertainty here. And I think, again, it's this question of, can we get big data sources? What we're trying to do, again, is link data from testing laboratories, who are the ones that generate these data, to cancer registries where we understand what the life histories of patients are. So we can begin to say, in 150,000 breast cancer cases, we're going to see some of these and be able to track them.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that. It's just sort of getting those numbers and keeping track of it. And so there is some, with BARD1, there is some, I'll say like smoke there, that there is a increased cancer risk and significant increased cancer risk, and it's on quite a few hereditary cancer panels. One thing that we do at Color is, because we're a testing lab, we get, you know, hundreds of people with these mutations, is we do have a lot of research collaborations where we do refer these people to participate in research and help get them connected with people who are particularly interested in tracking the families, tracking what those family histories look like. So if you're here and want, I'm happy to get your information and connect you with one of our researchers who's doing an ovarian cancer study, particularly mm-hmm. with things like BARD1 up at University of Washington.
So one of the things that probably most people don't know is that medical research is actually very siloed. I mean, I think that the layperson believes that medical research is shared among all researchers around the world, certainly in the U.S., and that apparently is not true. So one of the things that the Bracco Foundation does is have their researchers collaborate. So, Mr. Goldberg, can you talk a little bit more about the investigators who are funded and working collaboratively?
Well, actually, I'd turn over to Alan because he's really pioneered that from our perspective, because he's brought the other researchers from Stanford, like Allison and Jim, and we have researchers at Harvard together. And it's been fantastic because they've been thinking about, how can 1 + 1 + 1 = 5? How can we do things together, multiple institutions that we couldn't do alone. So maybe you can
chat a little bit about that. So, I mean, this started because Evan decided to fund us all, and but then we realized who the people were funded, and it wasn't a kind of shotgun wedding. We all like each other and get on with each other. It might have been different if we didn't, but but actually it's turned into a very collaborative group. We have a meeting at UCSF, in fact, on April the 25th of the group, people traveling from the neighbors from Stanford, but also the people from Boston at Harvard. And we have joint projects, and we've developed new ideas because we're working in a kind of unencumbered way. So I think this issue of people not sharing, it's kind of a natural thing when first of all, I'm the director of a cancer center. If I share your clinical data with anybody, I actually go to prison. I mean, it's a serious crime. Actually, I'll get deported, but, you know, that's... but, you know, we can't just volunteer data. There are laws about this kind of thing. And also, the way the scientific research is configured is, unfortunately, it's competitive because you've got to be first to discover something, otherwise you don't get the credit. And by the way, you don't pay your mortgage either then. So, you know, we've set up the whole system like this. It's not actually the best way to bring the field forward. Mm-hmm. And I think it's through the generosity of donors like Evan and others that actually frees us up from having... We're still competitive. We still want to win. But actually, we can do it in a different way, and we can share the joy of discovery. All the things I've described that I've done in my career have always been collaborations with large groups of people. I like working with people, and I believe it moves things forward in a much better way. So we've got to kind of unshackle things a bit, and this is one of the ways that I think we'll do it.
Okay, then our last question is, the latest knowledge that was presented tonight has been, how is that distributed and become throughout the country today? In other words, does everybody understand and get to know about the latest technology, the latest treatments?
Apparently not, based on your paper today.
I think, you know, people at places like Harvard and UCSF and Stanford were fortunate to be able really to specialize in these areas, right? So I'm a big nerd. All I do is think about breast cancer genetics, right? But so in the community, oncologists have to take care of everything. That's actually very challenging. And they may not know that much about this. So again, when we look at community practice and we see that it's falling short, this is not in any way a criticism. It's very hard to be a generalist. But again, I think it's a question of how we move this kind of expertise into the community so that everyone can benefit. I think Evan had some interesting ideas that we were talking about before.
Well, the internet could help.
Yes, the internet could help. And there also, we have to think of broader communities. So at UCSF, we look after people at Zuckerberg San Francisco General Hospital, and we have genetic counselors there. Mm-hmm. The challenge is there's 31 languages spoken at the general. Mm-hmm. And actually, many cultures, the concepts are just different, and the way that you simply don't just translate it into a different language. You have to culturally translate it so it means something in different communities. And we're really on the edge of doing that. And I think there's the more general issue of the low level of health literacy in even first world countries, that people don't really understand much about what governs their health. They don't understand almost anything about risk or proportionate risk, and they, you know, take things much more seriously than others that they should be thinking about. So there's a big job in trying to convert that into a health literate population, especially the underserved communities.
Well, good. Actually, I do have one more question, which is that
there's always one more.
From what was being described tonight about the very specifics about the cancer cells, that this sounds like it's precision medicine. Is that, would you agree with that, or can you?
Yeah, it's the exemplification of precision medicine. And, I think President Obama got it more or less right when he said it's the right treatment for the right patient at the right time. Mm-hmm. And what we've done in the past is to treat patient populations as an average and work out what's the best treatment for the average person. None of you are average. There's no tumor alike the same as any other tumor. and we have to figure out what's the best treatment for you and not for the person sitting next to you.
Do you think there's broad classifications of cancer like BRCA? I mean, that's what's kind of inspired me, is this notion of looking at cancers as a series of diseases that are different. What are some other maybe broad classifications?
There are types that are kind of dominant over where the cancer is. Now, it's always going to matter where the cancer is, because you don't want somebody who's used to sticking a knife around here sticking a knife down here, right? So that's going to matter for a long time. But once you get beyond that, the fact that it's a breast cancer with a BRCA mutation or an ovary cancer, it probably matters more, at least at later stages of treatment, that it's a BRCA mutation than where it is. Now, that's not true for all types of cancer yet, but as we uncover the molecular pathways that are disrupted in different cancers, I think it'll become like a Venn diagram. We'll have where the tumor is important, what type is important, and then you'll be in box A3, and it'll be a subtype like that, because you can't literally treat everybody completely separately. Mm-hmm. We don't have that many drugs.
I think it's a great point. And really, medicine has been organized at the level of what people are able to observe. So for years, really all we could observe was anatomy, right? There's a tumor in your breast. No, it's in your ovary. It's breast cancer. It's ovarian cancer. That's how these things got their names. Increasingly, as we can look more closely at the molecular basis, we no longer care so much about the anatomy. It's just not the level at which we're really concerned with these questions anymore. So yes, there's some of it. Certainly from a surgical point of view, I'm a medical oncologist, so I'm not cutting anywhere. I'm just giving drugs. And I think there, it's certainly much more of a sense where biology is beginning to trump anatomy in figuring out what we do. So very much precision medicine, precision treatment, and precision prevention.
Well, thank you. I want to thank our panel tonight, and I want to also mention that this presentation was being live streamed through Facebook on the BRCA Foundation's Facebook page. So our thanks to our expert panel on cancer and genetics that includes Dr. Allison Kurian from Stanford, Dr. Ashworth from UCSF, Lily Service from Color, the BRCA Foundation CEO Evan Goldberg, and cancer patient Doreen Castleman. Again, I am Judy Chan, a member of the Health and Medicine member-led forum and the moderator of tonight's program. We also thank our audience here, as well as those listening to the club's recording or the Facebook live stream recording later on. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating 114 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.